Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Sam Tracy. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland for a talk by Robert Einhorn. The title of today's talk is, Are We Heading Towards a World with Many Nuclear-Armed States? This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing today's talk is the president of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, George Look.
Our speaker today is Mr. Robert Einhorn, who will be speaking on the topic, Are We Heading Toward a World with Many Nuclear-Armed States? Mr. Robert Einhorn is a senior fellow in the Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative and the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology, both housed within the Foreign Policies Programs at Brookings. Mr. Einhorn focuses on arms control, both bilateral U.S.-Russian and multilateral agreements, on non-proliferation and regional security issues, including Iran, the Greater Middle East, South Asia, and Northeast Asia, and on U.S. nuclear weapons policies and programs. Before joining Brookings in May 2013, Mr. Einhorn served as the Department of State's Special Advisor for Non-Proliferation and Arms Control, a position that was created by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2009. In that capacity, he played a leading role in the formulation and execution of U.S. policies toward Iran's nuclear program, both with respect to sanctions and with the negotiations which led to the Iran nuclear deal. He also helped shape the Obama administration's overall approach to nonproliferation, supported nonproliferation goals through diplomatic contacts with China, Russia, and key non-aligned countries, and addressed nuclear security and strategic stability challenges in South Asia. He played a key role in the development of the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review and served as a U.S. delegation head in negotiations with South Korea on a successor civil nuclear agreement. Between 2001 and 2009, Mr. Einhorn was a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, where he directed the Proliferation Prevention Program. Prior to joining CSIS, he served in the positions of Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, and as a member of the State Department Policy Planning Staff. Before joining the State Department, he held various positions at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Mr. Einhorn has written extensively in the areas of arms control and nonproliferation. He has authored several books and has published numerous articles in such journals as Survival, The National Interest, Foreign Policy, Arms Control Today, The Washington Quarterly, and The Nonproliferation Review. Mr. Einhorn holds a bachelor's degree in government from Cornell University and a master's degree in public affairs and international relations from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Bob, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
George, thank you very much for the kind introduction, and thank you and Karen Look, who are my colleagues during my government career. Thanks for inviting me to the Mid-Coast Forum. It's a great honor for me. Thank you all for coming out and being with us in person, and for those in the radio audience, thanks for tuning in. As advertised by George, I'm going to address the question of whether we are destined to live in the dangerous and unstable world of many nuclear-armed countries. So far, global efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation have been very, very successful. 30 years ago, there were 9 nuclear-armed states. The 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, as well as India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. 30 years later, there are still 9 countries with nuclear weapons, the same ones as 30 years prior. And this is despite many dire predictions that there would be cascades of proliferation, that many countries would decide to go for nuclear weapons. But during that 30-year period, South Africa joined the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, after voluntarily dismantling its small nuclear arsenal, about half dozen nuclear weapons. Nuclear programs of Iraq, Libya, and Syria were stopped by coercive means. The Iraq program by Desert Storm and UN inspections. Libya's program was stopped by coercive diplomatic action by the United States and United Kingdom. And Syria's was stopped when Israel in 2007 bombed a nuclear reactor in the Syrian desert that North Korea was building for the Syrian regime. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus agreed to remove Soviet-era nuclear weapons from their territories and join the NPT as non-nuclear weapon states. A few years earlier, Argentina and Brazil gave up their nuclear plans when they transitioned from military to civilian rule. So it's a remarkable record. But in recent years, there have been worrisome developments that have raised questions about whether this very positive record can be sustained. One such development is that certain revisionist nuclear armed states are building up their nuclear and missile capabilities and acting aggressively toward their non-nuclear neighbors. In particular, Russia's unprovoked invasion of non-nuclear Ukraine could prompt other non-nuclear weapon states to reconsider whether they need nuclear weapons to safeguard their security. China is rapidly increasing both its conventional and nuclear capabilities and is bullying its non-nuclear neighbors in the South China and East China Seas, as well as across the Taiwan Strait. North Korea has no intention of giving up its increasingly capable and diverse nuclear and missile forces, and it's threatening to use nuclear weapons preemptively in the event of conflict on the Korean Peninsula. A second international development that increases pessimism about the future of nuclear nonproliferation is the sharp deterioration of U.S. relations with both Russia and China. Today's adversarial relations make it hard to imagine Moscow or Beijing cooperating with Washington to address proliferation threats. In the past, Russia and China were often America's partners in nonproliferation. Both countries played constructive roles in what was called the six-party talks with North Korea during the George W. Bush presidency, and in the P5+1 talks with Iran during the Obama presidency that led to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, also called the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. China and Russia voted with the United States to impose harsh UN Security Council sanctions on both North Korea and Iran. But such collaboration today is very unlikely. China and Russia now seem to prioritize their geostrategic interests over their non-proliferation goals. And one of their principal geostrategic interests is undermining U.S. power and U.S. influence around the world. Beijing and Moscow now regard North Korea and Iran as strategic partners in their common opposition to the U.S.-led, rules-based international order. China and Russia are helping North Korea and Iran evade economic sanctions that they once voted for. And they've made clear that they'll veto any new Security Council sanctions against either country. And now that both North Korea and Iran have become important arms suppliers to Russia for its war against Ukraine, there's little possibility that Moscow will join in pressuring them to curb their nuclear and missile programs. A third development is the relative decline in the U.S. post-Cold War primacy and also growing uncertainty about the future of U.S. overseas military presence and security commitments. Since the NPT negotiations in the 1960s, the United States has been the driving force in building and strengthening the global nonproliferation regime. It remains the regime's leading supporter, but its clout has diminished, and its ability to persuade or pressure others to follow its lead on nonproliferation matters has also diminished. When the U.S. dominated the worldwide civil nuclear energy market, it had leverage to compel its civil nuclear customers to accept strict nonproliferation constraints as conditions of nuclear supply. Today, countries embarking on nuclear energy programs can choose from a large number of nuclear suppliers, including some that are less insistent on rigorous nonproliferation controls than the United States. With the perception that the United States is pulling back from its overseas presence and commitments, some traditional friends of the United States, such as Saudi Arabia and Turkey, are now more inclined to hedge their bets, reach out to other countries such as Russia and China, and resist demands by the United States that they accept stringent nonproliferation constraints. And as the United States becomes vulnerable to nuclear attack from such potential adversaries as China and North Korea, U.S. allies wonder whether the United States will honor its security commitments and come to their defense if it means risking nuclear retaliation against the American homeland. The Biden administration has done much to restore confidence in the international role of the United States and in the reliability of U.S. security guarantees. But America's allies and partners are alarmed at the possible return of Donald Trump with his dismissive and transactional approach to U.S. alliances. And importantly, they're not just worried about Trump. They're worried that the American public, and not just the MAGA wing of the Republican Party, has grown tired of U.S. overseas engagement and security commitments. So, based on these and other developments we could discuss, one might predict that the number of countries possessing nuclear weapons will grow significantly in coming years. But in my view, to get a more accurate picture of the future of nonproliferation, it's necessary to focus not just on general trends, but on individual countries and on their particular incentives and disincentives for pursuing nuclear weapons. I'll focus briefly on several countries that are often seen as the most likely to reconsider their nuclear options in coming years. The logical place to start is probably Ukraine, the victim of aggression by nuclear-armed Russia. One might expect Ukrainians to want a nuclear deterrent to prevent Moscow from trying to erase it, to erase the country from off the map. But Ukraine, in my view, is no more likely to opt for nuclear weapons today than it was in the early 1990s when it agreed to the removal of Soviet-era nuclear weapons from its territory. Ukraine has major nuclear energy infrastructure with lots of nuclear power plants, but it lacks the specialized facilities for producing the highly enriched uranium or separated plutonium needed for nuclear weapons. Building those facilities would make little sense for Ukraine, at least for the foreseeable future. National energies and resources will be devoted to fighting the Russians and eventually rebuilding the country. But more fundamentally, Ukraine believes that its future is with the West. It knows that acquiring nuclear weapons could alienate its Western partners and reduce the likelihood of joining Western institutions such as the European Union and NATO. So what about NATO's European partners, especially the frontline states bordering Russia, and even countries like Germany? Is there a risk of their going nuclear? These countries are concerned that Putin's ambitions extend beyond Ukraine to NATO territory. They're pleased by the solidarity displayed by the alliance in supporting Ukraine, at least until now, and they're also pleased by recent force enhancements in frontline NATO states. But they were shocked by Donald Trump's recent comment that he would encourage Russia to do, I'm quoting him, to do whatever the hell it wants with NATO countries that don't meet their defense spending commitments. Some Europeans have begun talking about alternatives to the U.S. To U.S. security guarantees, including a European nuclear force based on the French and British nuclear deterrence. Some lawmakers in Berlin have even raised the possibility of an independent German nuclear deterrent. But in my view, unless a re-elected Trump decided to renounce NATO's Article 5 commitment and withdraw U.S. troops from Europe, I don't believe these ideas will go anywhere. Most Europeans, including the German government, see no realistic alternative to continued reliance on the U.S. nuclear umbrella. U.S. allies in Northeast Asia are often mentioned as possible candidates for joining the nuclear weapons club. South Korea is alarmed by North Korea's growing nuclear threat, and Seoul has serious questions about the reliability of U.S. security guarantees. Opinion polls indicate strong support among the South Korean people for acquiring nuclear weapons. With North Korea now able to strike the United States homeland with nuclear weapons, South Koreans wonder whether the United States would come to their defense if it meant exposing U.S. cities to nuclear attack. They ask rhetorically whether the United States would risk San Francisco to save Seoul. But South Korea's leaders are also aware of the significant downsides of acquiring nuclear weapons. They know that becoming a nuclear armed state would seriously erode the U.S.-South Korean alliance and remove South Korea from under the U.S. nuclear umbrella. They know that becoming nuclear would trigger strong penalties by China, South Korea's number one trading partner. And it could undermine South Korea's aspiration to be regarded as a responsible, influential player on the world stage. And it could terminate South Korea's civil nuclear cooperation with other countries, essentially ending its reliance on nuclear power for about 30% of its electricity. So for now, the administration of President Yoon Suk-yeol would prefer to rely on the U.S. security guarantee rather than pursue its own nuclear deterrent. But that preference is conditional. It depends on the strengthening of the U.S. extended nuclear deterrent. And in the last few years, Washington and Seoul have made major progress in strengthening this extended nuclear deterrent, including by increasing the frequency of deployments of U.S. strategic assets to the Northeast Asia region, by stepping up joint military exercises in which the allies consider responses, joint responses, to North Korea's use of nuclear weapons, and by establishing a high-level bilateral nuclear consultative group that would enable South Korea to play a more prominent role in the planning and execution of the U.S. extended deterrent. So continued progress in the strengthening of the credibility of extended deterrence would make it unlikely, in my view, that Seoul would pursue its own nuclear capability. But what about Japan? Public discussion of the nuclear option is no longer a taboo subject in Japan. Many Japanese, like many South Koreans, question the reliability of U.S. security commitments. And while Japanese share South Korea's concerns about the nuclear threat, they're also worried, probably more worried, about the threat from China, which is rapidly building up its nuclear capabilities and asserting sovereignty over several Japanese claimed and administered islands. And unlike South Korea, Japan has already developed uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing capabilities, which will allow them to move toward nuclear weapons relatively quickly. But Japan, in my view, is even less likely than South Korea to acquire nuclear weapons. Public opinion in Japan remains strongly opposed to acquiring nuclear weapons, reflecting its history as the only victim of nuclear attack. It's giving priority to conventional means of deterring and responding to aggression by China and North Korea. They're nearly doubling their military spending, acquiring long-range conventional military strike capabilities, and working with the United States to strengthen missile defenses. It's also joined with Seoul and Washington to build up trilateral defense cooperation, which is quite remarkable given some of the historical tensions between Tokyo and Seoul. And the Japanese are just as aware of as South Korea of the many downsides of pursuing an indigenous nuclear weapons capability. So a nuclear-armed Japan is also unlikely. The country most likely to become the 10th nuclear-armed state is Iran. The 2015 JCPOA would have blocked Iran's path to nuclear weapons until at least the year 2030, but it's now dead. President Trump withdrew from it, and Iran responded by ramping up its uranium enrichment program. The Biden administration hoped, when it took office in January 2021, it hoped to restore compliance with the JCPOA, but talks to that end broke down in August 2022. Since then, Iran has continued to increase its inventory of uranium enriched to 60%, which is close to weapons grade. If it decided to break out of its existing obligations and build nuclear weapons, it could produce enough weapons-grade uranium for a single nuclear bomb in about a week or so, and enough for several nuclear bombs in a little more than a month. Once it produced enough weapons-grade uranium, it could fabricate a crude first-generation nuclear device in about 6 months, and a nuclear weapon that could be delivered on a missile in perhaps another year or two. Iran is rapidly becoming what is called a threshold nuclear weapon state, able, if it's so decided, to produce nuclear weapons in a relatively short period of time. A key question is whether Iran will choose to remain a threshold state or cross the threshold and actually build nuclear weapons. At least so far, the U.S. intelligence community sees no evidence of nuclear weapons-related activities in Iran that would indicate that it has already made the decision to cross the threshold. Some observers maintain that Iran will be content to remain a threshold state, perhaps indefinitely. That might be the case if it believed crossing the threshold would involve major risks, including harsh economic sanctions or even a preemptive military attack by Israel or the United States, and if it believed that its current regional strategy of using proxy forces to expand its regional influence and deter Israel and the United States was succeeding without having nuclear weapons. However, some other observers contend that a nuclear-armed Iran is practically inevitable. They argue that Iran has invested so much to acquire the infrastructure for producing nuclear weapons that it won't stop short of achieving that goal. And they point out that the failure of Iran's April 13 conventional missile and drone attack against Israel could convince Iran, the failure of that attack could convince Iran that it needed a nuclear deterrent to ensure its security. I don't think it's inevitable that Iran will actually decide to produce nuclear weapons. I believe it could go either way. But even if Iran chooses for the time being to remain a threshold state, the possibility of a future Iranian decision to produce nuclear weapons would continue to exist. And that would mean that pressures for proliferation elsewhere in the Middle East would remain, nowhere more than in Saudi Arabia. And we don't have to speculate about Saudi Arabia's nuclear intentions. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has openly declared his determination to acquire nuclear weapons if Iran does. Given Saudi interest in keeping the nuclear options open, eyebrows were raised last year by media reports that the United States and Saudi Arabia were negotiating a bilateral civil nuclear agreement. The Saudis are conditioning their normalization of relations with Israel on U.S. acceptance of three demands: a civil nuclear deal, a U.S. security guarantee for Saudi Arabia, and progress toward statehood for the Palestinians. As part of the civil nuclear deal, the Saudis want the United States to build a uranium enrichment facility in the kingdom. An enrichment facility can produce low-enriched uranium to fuel civil nuclear reactors, but it's also inherently capable of producing highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. I support reaching a civil nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia. It could help revitalize the U.S. nuclear industry, and it could diversify the Saudi economy and energy mix. It could also give the United States the opportunity to influence future Saudi nuclear energy choices. But I don't support the U.S. building an enrichment facility in Saudi Arabia. In my view, there's no compelling nuclear energy or commercial justification for such a facility at the current time. In my view, a decision on enrichment can be deferred perhaps for another 10 years. However, the Biden administration strongly supports Saudi Israeli normalization and believes that meeting Saudi demands on nuclear cooperation may be necessary to gain Saudi support for normalization. Therefore, President Biden may agree to build an enrichment plant in the kingdom. Negotiations are underway right now. It was the reason, I think, one of the reasons that Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan visited both Riyadh and Jerusalem in the last week or so. So I think it's very possible that President Biden could agree to this enrichment facility. That would erode the global norm against the spread, the proliferation of enrichment and reprocessing facilities. And I think it could open the door to countries like Russia or China building such facilities in other non-nuclear weapon states. There hasn't been any such transfer by a state to a non-nuclear weapon state in, you know, about 40 years. This would break that record, that a very impressive record, and I think open the door to less responsible countries engaging in this kind of cooperation. But while problematic from a global perspective, I doubt that construction of an enrichment plant would actually help Saudi Arabia acquire nuclear weapons. The Biden administration would insist on strong measures to prevent the enrichment facility from being used in a nuclear weapons program. In particular, it would insist on rigorous monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and on a requirement that the facility be operated exclusively by Americans to avoid any transfer of sensitive enrichment technology to the Saudis. The Biden administration would also probably insist that Saudi Arabia not engage in any nuclear cooperation with other states, including China and Russia, which would further reduce the likelihood of the Saudis gaining the critical foreign assistance they would need to pursue a nuclear weapons program. So even if a U.S.-Saudi deal involved an enrichment facility, it would be unlikely to help the Saudis achieve their declared goal of matching Iran's nuclear capability. The kingdom, in other words, is likely to remain a non-nuclear weapon state. Finally, I'll say a few words about Turkey. Under President Erdogan, Turkey has sought to play an assertive role in the Middle East. Although a NATO member, it has charted an independent foreign policy that has often frustrated its allies and strained relations with the United States. It has a large and growing industrial base. It's buying nuclear power reactors and advanced air defense systems from Russia. And it has refused to rule out a uranium enrichment capability. Even more disturbing, although Turkey is an NPT party, Erdogan has said publicly that it's unacceptable that some countries can have nuclear weapons and Turkey cannot. Clearly, Turkey deserves to be on any proliferation watch list. Still, the likelihood that Turkey will pursue nuclear weapons remains low. A nuclear capability would not address its main security preoccupation, which is Kurdish separatism. Moreover, Turkey regards Iran as a rival for regional influence, not as a military threat that might compel a Turkish nuclear deterrent. Despite frayed relations with the United States and Europe, Ankara's economy remains heavily dependent on trade and investment with the West, and its military remains closely tied in with its NATO allies. A nuclear weapons program would put those vital links in jeopardy. Depending on the evolution of the regional security landscape, as well as possible changes in Turkey's domestic political landscape. Incentives could change, but for now at least, Turkey is not a high proliferation risk. So that concludes my survey of the usual suspects, the countries often considered the most likely to pursue nuclear weapons in the future. When one focuses on individual countries, the outlook for nonproliferation seems somewhat less pessimistic than if one focuses only on the worrisome developments that I mentioned earlier. Today, I believe the only non-nuclear weapon state with a significant probability of acquiring nuclear weapons is Iran. And there's a reasonable possibility that Iran will opt to remain a threshold state and not actually determined to pursue nuclear weapons. But circumstances can change. There are several critical uncertainties that could affect the likelihood of additional nuclear armed states in the period ahead. One such uncertainty is the outcome on Ukraine. If a nuclear armed predator is seen as winning, as significantly compromising Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, non-nuclear weapon states threatened by nuclear-armed neighbors may be more inclined to reconsider their nuclear status. On the other hand, if Russia is seen as having failed to achieve its goals, Moscow's aggression would have little effect on non-proliferation incentives. Another uncertainty is the evolving security situation in the Middle East. If regional security dynamics in the wake of the Gaza war result in Iran deciding to cross the nuclear threshold, proliferation pressures will intensify, especially in Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, if an emerging coalition involving Israel, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and other Sunni Arab states effectively deters Iran and its proxies and stabilizes the region, proliferation pressures may be reduced. Another critical factor will be the degree of confidence of U.S. allies and partners in the reliability of U.S. security guarantees. Strengthening perceptions of the U.S. extended deterrent and maintaining a formidable U.S. overseas military presence will dampen support for independent nuclear capabilities. However, the scaling back of U.S. overseas commitments and the reemergence of America First policies would have the opposite effect. A closely related variable is the identity of national leaders. There's already been much speculation about the implications for nuclear proliferation of another Trump presidency. But prospects for proliferation will also be affected by who succeeds other world leaders. Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, President Putin, President Erdogan, as well as pro-alliance leaders, Prime Minister Kishida of Japan and President Yoon of South Korea. And so the continued success of the global nuclear nonproliferation regime can hardly be taken for granted. Much will depend on the United States. It must continue to reassure its allies and partners and play a stabilizing role in key regions. It must seek to reduce the threat from revisionist nuclear armed states through a combination of deterrence and diplomacy. It must uphold critical nonproliferation norms, such as compliance with IAEA safeguards and restraint in the transfer of sensitive technologies, and not least, It must recognize that it can't do the job alone. It must work closely with other countries committed to the fight against nuclear proliferation. If the United States continues to play such a leadership role, it should be possible to avoid a world with an ever-growing number of nuclear-armed states. It might even be possible to hold the line at 9. And so on that optimistic, you might say, Pollyannish note, I'll conclude my remarks and look forward to your comments and your questions.
Thank you very much, Bob. I think you're a little more optimistic than I am, but I hope you're right on all of this. I used to take the opportunity to ask the first question. All the states you mentioned as possible proliferators are members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which commits them not to develop or deploy nuclear weapons. Could you give some comments on whether that treaty really still represents a norm, and if one country breaks it, whether that's going to kind of open the floodgates for others?
It's been a very powerful norm, George. I think it's one of the most successful treaties. I think more countries adhere to the Non-Proliferation Treaty than almost any other treaty. There are just a handful of countries that have not joined it. One country, North Korea, withdrew from it. It's a kind of a special case, and that was a long time ago. That was over 30 years ago, and I think the next country that decides to withdraw, and hopefully there won't be any countries, but the next country might be the canary in the coal mine. It would be a very pessimistic indicator of what's to come. I think a lot of countries are reluctant to withdraw from the NPT because a lot of international opprobrium would be heaped on it if it did. So I think that's a real disincentive for doing that. Of course, if a country like Iran felt that its vital national interests were jeopardized by staying in the treaty, I think it would withdraw. But I do think the Non-Proliferation Treaty serves as a powerful norm and a disincentive to non-proliferation. And I should mention, all countries that are complying with the NPT today, they're being surveilled. They're being inspected on a daily basis by the IAEA, and it's very, very hard for these countries to leave the treaty, violate these obligations to the IAEA, and get away with it. I think they would face some very strong criticism, and perhaps more than criticism, in some cases military attack. So it's a powerful norm, and hopefully it'll stay that way.
Can you compare relative threats from nuclear state actors, rogue state actors, and non-state nuclear armed groups? What are the chances of terrorism, nuclear terrorism?
Well, we were discussed this with a number of you last night, but in years past, especially in the Obama administration, when we weren't terribly worried about a reemergence of great power competition at that point in 2009 to 2016. By 2014, Russia was kind of showing its true nature with its annexation of Crimea. But in 2009 to 2014, Russian aggression wasn't at the top of our agenda. China hadn't become this pacing nuclear threat. North Korea hadn't ramped up its capabilities. And at that time, nuclear terrorism was the main problem. And the way to deal with nuclear terrorism is to prevent the terrorists from getting their hands on the wherewithal to commit nuclear terrorism. So you had to safeguard these sensitive nuclear materials and nuclear weapons from seizure by by the terrorists. And so the Obama administration made a major effort to get countries around the world to safeguard their nuclear facilities, their nuclear materials. The U.S. Spent a lot of money aiding these countries to strengthen their nuclear security procedures. And that, I think, greatly reduced the likelihood of nuclear terrorism. I think recently we've kind of lost focus on nuclear terrorism as we've, you know, as we've shifted to dealing with the threats from China, North Korea, Russia, and Iran. I think we need to refocus that effort because I think the risks are still there, and I think there are terrorist groups and very sophisticated non-state actors who pose a threat. I mean, look at the Houthis, look at Hezbollah. These are very capable, well-organized, non-state actors. I don't know that we have any specific evidence that any of them are going for nuclear weapons at this stage, but if they did, I think it would be a great concern.
Do you see any of the current nuclear powers as likely to sell weapons to terrorists?
I am very dubious. I think as much as Russia and China and North Korea give us fits, I don't think they have incentives for enabling non-state actors or terrorist groups to get nuclear weapons. I would hope that even given the very acrimonious relations we have with each of these governments, they would recognize a common interest with us in preventing terrorists from getting their hands on the wherewithal to commit nuclear terrorism. Hopefully we could engage with them, but we have to continue our efforts with like-minded countries to ensure that they have the means to safeguard their nuclear materials.
We had several questions also related to civilian nuclear power and the fact that with climate change, a lot of proposals to increase the nuclear power production in the world, how big a contribution is that to likely to be to proliferation?
Most civil nuclear cooperation involves no or minimal risk of nuclear weapons proliferation. Building a nuclear reactor, a power reactor, a research reactor has very little risk. The risk comes when a country acquires what are called fuel cycle capabilities. The capability, for example, to take spent, used fuel irradiated in a nuclear reactor, which always will have plutonium as part of it, and using chemical methods to separate the plutonium. Once it has the ability to reprocess plutonium, it can have nuclear weapons. Similarly, once you have the capability to enrich uranium, and you need enriched uranium for most nuclear reactors. But once you have the capability to enrich uranium to very low levels, it's below 5% enrichment is sufficient to fuel a nuclear reactor. But once you have the ability to do that, you also inherently have the capability to reconfigure that facility and produce highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. So, you know, if you have the growth of civil nuclear energy worldwide, that contains certain risks, but if you are vigilant in preventing the proliferation of these so-called fuel cycle capabilities, then I think you can impede proliferation, even with a rapid growth of nuclear energy worldwide.
Several people also wanted to know about the role of missile defenses in all of this. Is there any realistic defense against nuclear ballistic missiles, and does that play a role in the decision of countries on whether to acquire the weapons?
I think, I remember, George, Karen, you and I were involved in these negotiations in the early days, there's Rick Kessler also, in the early 1980s when Reagan came with his Star Wars idea of this perfectly effective missile defense, space-based, and people kind of mocked that. And at that time, we really didn't have the technology to shoot down a missile. They say it's as hard as shooting a bullet with another bullet. People didn't believe that this was going to be an effective technology. Well, great strides have been made since then. I mean, you see it. Look at the Iranian effort. They fired 300 projectiles at Israel. Most of them were intercepted. Now, there was some advance warning and so forth, and they were probably not the best Iranian missiles, but it's an indication of how effective missile defenses have really become. And how does this inhibit proliferation? Well, North Korea is producing all kinds of ballistic missiles of various various ranges. Use short range on the peninsula and ICBM range to strike the United States. South Koreans and Japanese want to be sure that they can impede, that they can thwart efforts by North Korea to strike them with ballistic missiles. If we can work with those countries in having effective missile defenses, they will be less concerned about their own security and perhaps more able to withstand pressures to acquire nuclear weapons themselves. So I think it's in the U.S. interest. And now it was interesting. In the day when we were working on this, missile defenses, the Republicans liked those, the Democrats didn't like them. Now everyone likes missile defenses, believes that they are effective and can be destabilizing and can be used to impede nuclear proliferation.
Here's a kind of a compound question. What is your view of the likability? What is your view of the probability that nuclear weapons will be used sometime in the reasonably near future? And under what conditions could the major powers be drawn in and use nuclear weapons if, say, India and Pakistan decided to have a nuclear exchange? Yeah.
What's the likelihood that nuclear weapons will be used? We're hearing a lot of very threatening things. We hear Vladimir Putin rattling his nuclear saber, threatening to use nuclear weapons first if the Russian interests are seriously jeopardized. I think he succeeded in deterring, with these nuclear threats, he's deterring NATO countries and the United States from putting ground troops in Ukraine. He believes he succeeded in making it more unlikely that the United States and others would provide long-range military equipment to Ukraine. So I think he's succeeding with these nuclear threats. I think Kim Jong-un talks about preemptive use of nuclear weapons. Why? In part, he's copying Putin, but in part, he believes that by threatening nuclear weapons, the United States, South Korea, and Japan will be more cautious, more restrained, won't want to mess with him for fear of instigating his use of nuclear weapons. So, but this talk, I think, gives the impression that there's a growing likelihood that nuclear weapons will be used. I think it's unlikely that a country will intentionally use nuclear weapons. I think, if a country decided, okay, I'm going to initiate nuclear weapons today, it would know the high probability of nuclear retaliation. And I think that's less likely. I think much more likely today is that nuclear weapons could be used as a result of inadvertent escalation from a conventional conflict, that there could be some terrible misperception, miscalculation, or accident that could that could lead a relatively small-scale conventional conflict from escalating, getting out of control. And so I think the effort today needs to focus heavily on avoiding the use of nuclear weapons, avoiding any conventional conflict erupting as a result of accident, miscalculation, misperception. And there are policies that can be used to try to reduce the likelihood of inadvertent nuclear war. But I think that's the real probability today, unintentional use of nuclear weapons, inadvertent rather than premeditated, purposeful use.
I'm going to apologize to our members and guests here today because we're not going to get to all of these questions. I think we have time for one more. And the one I would want to end with is, would you rate the level of interest and consensus in Washington on nuclear nonproliferation as a high priority for the U.S., and have you seen changes to it in recent years?
I think, as I mentioned before, in the Obama administration, it was near the top of administration priorities. I think with the reemergence of great power competition, nonproliferation has drifted down in terms of priority. 10, 15, 20 years ago, we believed that China and Russia really shared an interest in preventing the proliferation of nuclear weapons. That may still be the case to some extent, but as I mentioned in my remarks, China and Russia are now placing the highest priority on serving their geostrategic interests rather than their nonproliferation interests. So take, for example, with North Korea, or Iran. I think China and Russia are now less interested in working with us to make sure that North Korea and Iran's nuclear programs don't expand. I think they're no longer working with us. I think at the end of the day, they wouldn't prefer Iran to have nuclear weapons, but they're not going to work with us to constrain Iran, and that's unfortunate. And I think that's because their commitment to nonproliferation has receded. Some people even think that the U.S. commitment to nonproliferation is declining. They cite the possible willingness of the Biden administration to provide an enrichment facility in Saudi Arabia, prioritizing geostrategic over nonproliferation. I'm not so sure of that. I think any civil nuclear agreement with Saudi Arabia would also give a lot of importance to constraining proliferation. But I think there is a risk today that nonproliferation will recede in international importance relative to these growing geostrategic concerns.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very, very interesting.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk by Robert Einhorn, who recently spoke at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Sam Tracy. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.